Secret Wars.
Marvel supervillains are coming.
Secret Wars.
Can the Marvel superheroes stop them?
Marvel supervillains and superheroes figures each sold separately. Here, Dr. Doom and the Doom Platoon. Magneto, Dr. Octopus. There, Captain America and the Champions of Freedom. Spider-Man and Wolverine.
Secret Wars. The secret's out.
Dr. Doom and Spider-Man from the Marvel Secret Wars collection. Other figures each sold separately. From Mattel.
Hello, welcome to Dave's Marvel Universe. I am your host, J. David Weider. Thanks to the power of hypnosis, I am compelled to ask you to call me Dave. And this show has a really simple premise. I read and discuss a single Marvel comic per episode so long as it was published in the 1980s. This time I have something very special, at least special to me. To set you up, I want to take you back to 1982-ish. This is when a 4-year-old Dave took a field trip with his preschool class. We didn't go to a park or a Chuck E. Cheese or anything like that. We went to a nearby bank, which sounds like a strange setup, but stay with me. I didn't know where we were going on the van ride over. I had no idea what was about to happen, but what happened that day was that I met Spider-Man. For context, keep in mind that this is when Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends was airing on NBC on Saturday mornings. And it aired alongside the Incredible Hulk cartoon of the same era, which initially was my big draw. But I soon grew to love Spider-Man, so he was front and center in my mind, so this was a big deal to little Dave. So they gathered our class in there, and there was Spider-Man. And bear in mind, this wasn't somebody's uncle in a homemade suit. Oh no, this was the real deal. Marvel had fully licensed actors in professionally made costumes, and they could actually be rented out for various purposes, kids' parties or what have you. Jonathan Frakes, for example, was the Captain America for his time, and he would tell stories about showing up at kids' parties on the hood of a car just to make it dramatic. And since we're dealing with professional actors, this guy was able to get into the character of Spider-Man, and he had it down. He had the voice, he had the mannerisms. It was top-notch. I vividly remember us being taken upstairs to the mezzanine after an initial meeting in the lobby. So the second floor overlooked that lobby. We were lined up alongside the stairs. He comes running up and perfectly in character just goes, "Hi, guys." I mean, it's hard to convey how well he did this. It sounded just like he walked off the cartoon. And once he got seated at a table, we all lined up and we were able to one by one get an autograph from Spider-Man, the real Spider-Man, we thought. And I was nervous trying to think of something to say to him. And what came out of my mouth when I got to him is, "I really like your cartoon." He was gracious enough and signed my whatever it was, and I moved on. But we all debated on the ride back to preschool whether that was the real Spider-Man or not. Years later, I would start assembling a run of The Amazing Spider-Man, thanks to fellow podcaster Michael Bailey. And as unique as that experience was for me, I found a story that not only matched the magic of that experience, but enhanced it. It became so much more. There have been a lot of attempts to make a story that defines who Spider-Man is, who is Peter Parker at his core. And those come with varying degrees of success and failure. Most revolve around the core saying, "With great power must come great responsibility." And let's make sure we get that right. Because you don't automatically get responsible when you get great power. It doesn't work that way. The responsibility aspect of having great power is something you have to work at. So that saying, being phrased properly, is important. With great power must come great responsibility. You must rise to meet the challenge. And very few stories really nailed that aspect of Spider-Man, the working at responsibility aspect. The issue we're covering this time manages to do that and do it deftly. When I look at some of the great multi-part storylines that try to define Peter Parker and define his core mantra, I sometimes cock an eyebrow because it's done in an 11-page backup story. The greatest part about this particular story is that in it, Spider-Man doesn't fight a villain. The city isn't in peril. Now, we have a front-loaded story, a main story in which Spider-Man fights Thunderbolt. I'm not really going to talk about that because it's a fight. That's all it is. It's there to serve the purpose of giving some readers action. Instead, we see Spider-Man going up against a foe he cannot beat. It's interesting because Spider-Man fits into this realm where he's something of a street-level hero like Daredevil or Luke Cage. I mean, he's stopping muggings in alleys, goes up against organized crime, but he's also so much more. His power set can put him into the realm of giant supervillain mayhem, even cosmic threats. Spider-Man occupies his own realm within the 616 universe. Captain America represents the ideal of a nation. Iron Man represents scientific progress. The Hulk is the monster within. But Spider-Man, he represents average humanity achieving great things. I'm excited to look at a story that really nails that down. So after a podcast promo break, we look at The Amazing Spider-Man number 248, an 11-page story that takes that element of humanity and tears your heart out with it. I'll be right back.
Hi, I'm John Wilson.
And I'm Michael Kaiser.
And we're the hosts of the podcast Make Ours Marvel. You know, here we are in 2018, 10 years into the Marvel Cinematic Universe.
Yeah, can you believe we live in a world where everyone's old Aunt Petunia knows who Iron Man is?
It's crazy, right?
So, to celebrate, we're on our mission to explore the roots of the Marvel Universe.
You know, you've thought about it. Some of you may have even done it. And now we're going to do it too.
We're diving back into the long boxes of Marvel's history and podcasting our way through the whole universe.
All of it. Every superhero issue. And if I can convince Mike, we'll even do Sergeant Fury.
And it's not going to be one issue per episode. That'd take forever.
It's still going to take forever.
But no, we're going to talk about as many comics as we can in an hour.
Yep, an hour and, you know, maybe a little change. Every week, Marvel Comics. So it'd be super cool if you came along for the ride.
Look for us every Friday at MakeOursMarvel.com.
That's MakeOursMarvel.com or on iTunes and all the other usual podcasty places.
And if you want to read along with us and send us your thoughts, we might even read emails.
So until Avengers Infinity War gets a spin-off Warlock in the Infinity Watch TV show,
Make Ours Marvel.
Welcome back, everybody. The Amazing Spider-Man number 248 comes to us with a January 1984 cover date. The cover art is by John Romita Jr. and Terry Austin, and we have a young boy holding a poster of Spider-Man fighting Thunderball, but his attention is on Spider-Man himself, whose hand is on his shoulder. I would say this is a cover that could stand to be on more iconic cover lists. It mixes both 11-page stories in the book in an organic way. The cover also knows where the power of this issue lies, in the backup story, so it takes the emotional punch and puts it right on Front Street. It's a well-done cover that needs another look, I think. The story we're looking at in this issue is The Kid Who Collects Spider-Man. Written by Roger Stern with art by Ron Frenz, inked by Terry Austin, lettered by Joseph Rosen, and colored by Christy Scheel. Diving into the very brief synopsis, Jacob Conover writes a column for the Daily Bugle called Conover's Corner. And one column is a profile of Timothy Harrison, who is 9 years old and the biggest Spider-Man fan on the planet. Late one night, Spider-Man pays Timothy a visit. Timothy shows Spider-Man his collection of Spidey memorabilia, and Spider-Man shows off his powers. As Spider-Man opens up to Timothy about his origin and his motivation for being Spider-Man, Tim requests to know one thing. What is Spider-Man's real identity? After a moment of hesitation, Spider-Man takes off his mask to show the kid that he is Peter Parker. As Spider-Man leaves Timothy, we learn from the column that Timothy has leukemia and only has a few weeks left to live, meaning Spider-Man's secret is safe. But it also means that Spider-Man just granted the last wish of a child who will leave this world in a short time. And the curtain closes on Amazing Spider-Man number 248. Jumping right into commentary here, the story has no contrived setup. Spider-Man arrives in Tim's room where the story begins, and, you know, just to say this up front and get it out of the way, if you have any lewd jokes, this is not the story to waste those on. This is not inappropriate, there's nothing implied, let it go. But ultimately, just to get back to my commentary, the story just starts. And it starts where it should, in all honesty. And we have Jacob Conover's column providing the setup. But it also weaves its way organically and comfortably through the story, supplementing the visual narrative and not getting in its way. Visually, as we arrive in the story, we see Tim has a Star Wars poster on his wall and a rug on the floor. It doesn't automatically let us know that we're in a cancer hospital. If you were reading this for the first time, it manages to retain its surprise and gut punch at the end, without being overly clever and annoying. The Star Wars poster is a standout for me because it really smacks of real life. Kids in 1984 still would have had a Star Wars poster on, most likely a Return of the Jedi poster since that was the previous year's biggest movie. But it's real. That's what a kid would have on his wall. It also comes back later on rereads because you realize that a lot has been done to make Timothy comfortable, to make this room as comfortable as possible for his, what would be his last days. It doesn't look like a sterile hospital room. It doesn't have all these machines everywhere. It feels like home, so there's a certain level of almost hospice-style care, making these last few weeks for this character as comfortable as possible. At the early part of the story here, we should know that something's up with Tim. There should be something standing out because Spider-Man's in pure showman mode. The same quick quips that he would use with villains, he's using with Tim. Now, that does give pause to think, is this maybe a dream sequence? What's the trick here? You don't necessarily know what the twist is going to be, but you know there's going to be some kind of twist. The nice thing is that Stern has this peel itself apart throughout the story as Spider-Man gets closer and closer to his real self. He's kind of like an ogre. He has layers like an onion. And I think I just put a simile within a simile. But Stern really does a good job of taking that bravado down to a more human level as the story progresses and as Spider-Man reveals more and more of himself to Tim. One thing you'll probably note if you're reading along is that the art looks very, very Ditko-esque. And Ron Frenz nails that Ditko look. He really does. For this story, it feels right. We're going back to Spider-Man's core origin. We're looking at his core self. So it makes sense that this would have a Ditko look. It's not a spoof or a swipe. It really isn't too far off of Frenz's natural style. So as much as there's kind of a moment of pause when you look at it, it does feel right to have it be an homage to Ditko's style. And within this, we actually revisit Spider-Man's origin momentarily, which is another example of an 11-page story that had a huge impact. That's right, go back and read Amazing Fantasy number 15. It's 11 pages long. And yet, that story remains intact to this day. There are variations on the theme, but that story remains ultimately intact. Is it possibly the perfect origin tale? I don't know, you decide. And there's a bit of a play on this because many Ditko panels are homaged, yet Frenz keeps Peter's features hidden in shadow. And that's symbolic of Peter being honest about everything, being upfront, but not providing certain details, not necessary details. And yet, a Spider-Man reader can easily look at these panels and fill in the blanks and know exactly what we're looking at. I would be really, really curious to see a non-initiated Spider-Man fan read through this story and really get the full brunt of this origin for the first time in the context of the story itself. I do want to make some comments on the origin since it's here, it's presented. I have a few observations. One, Peter is a mostly well-adjusted kid. That wasn't my original take for a long time, but the more I reread it and the more I looked at alternative tellings like Parallel Lives by Jerry Conway, I realize in the original telling, Peter has a lot on his plate. His parents are a mystery. They're obviously dead, but he doesn't ask questions. He isn't moody. He doesn't feel slighted because he knows he has an uncle and aunt that dote on him and love him. If there's a huge challenge that Peter is facing, it's that he's already in the mindset of an adult. I mean, he's trying to be a normal teenager, but his intelligence really prevents that. He's geared towards science. He's geared towards what will be his college career. Peter's intelligence works against him because, as crappy as this is, intelligence can be feared, especially amongst teenagers. We all remember when athletics got rewarded. They got attention. They got all kinds of rewards. And I guess, truthfully speaking, athletics is more glamorous. And yes, I will say that if a athlete works on himself or herself and makes something of that, the time and effort put in, I can give you that, that there's something deserving there. But academics, at least by peers, tend to be looked down upon. And Peter's level of intellect is odd. It's a lack of understanding by his peers. It's also, well, if we're being honest, it reveals inadequacy because you've got somebody like Peter who's breaking the curves, throwing off test scores, getting the attention of teachers saying, oh, he's so brilliant. And yet here you are trying to work, especially like the average person who's not really great at athletics or academics. That's got to be frustrating. Athletics do take a team approach, and a lot of people may work out together and try to build a better team. Academics can do something like that, but typically you're all alone studying and building your brain. So it's not usually a social activity, and it can throw off somebody's social relationships with their peers. So Peter may be well-adjusted, but his peers don't understand that. While his teachers, his aunt and uncle, they get it. I would say Peter's what's been called an old soul in a young body. Looking at the origin as a whole, you take out fatalism, the idea that we know Spider-Man's going to become this superhero and he's going to be published for 50, 60 years and more. If you take that out of the equation, you're dealing with a Shakespearean-level tale of tragedy. Yes, he goes on to be a superhero, but ultimately Amazing Fantasy number 15 is a morality tale, which makes it interesting that it's echoed in this particular story. Because Peter is a kid that's dealing with this huge gift and simultaneously has a huge loss all in one swoop. And he has to learn to deal with that. So I guess really the question posed to us by Spider-Man's origin is, how do we handle life? I mean, we take the good, we take the bad. How do we constructively move forward when tragedy hits our life? And I think in the context of our origin, the fact that our protagonist was a kid, a 15 or 14-year-old kid, it makes a huge difference. He doesn't make all the right decisions, and he ends up paying for that. But at the same time, he doesn't go out and beat up Flash Thompson to impress Liz Allen either. Also, it's easy to forget that Spider-Man's costume, and his web shooters also, they were both designed for entertainment value. Now to that, Peter didn't go out seeking fame and fortune. He was testing his powers, and these things came to him. He made a flashy wrestling debut, and all these offers came to him. They were laid at his feet. And just like almost anybody, he took what was offered to him. He saw an opportunity, and he ran with it. The movies have made a habit of having Peter be seeking money, or seeking fame, or seeking revenge in the Amazing Spider-Man's case. In this case, those all came to him, and it got to his ego, and he made a decision. And that decision cost Uncle Ben his life. Potentially. I'm going to get to that in just a second. Stern also works in Peter explaining the web shooters. So again, you can show this story to somebody who's not familiar with Spider-Man and they can jump right in without any prep. It's not shoehorned in. It actually feels natural that he would show Tim his web shooters. It would show how it works because he's sharing stuff with this kid. And again, it's more symbolism of him revealing parts of himself that the public doesn't necessarily see. The real person underneath the costume and the real tech. And not for nothing, as he's describing the web shooters, you almost feel like, yeah, that's plausible, that's scientific. It's not, but it sounds like it could be, and that's kind of the best thing about pseudoscience is when it sounds like it really could work. And then Peter explains Uncle Ben, without saying it's Uncle Ben. And the more I think about Uncle Ben, there's a lot that comes with that. Because the stance that Amazing Fantasy 15 takes is that Peter didn't take the moment to trip the guy, and that's what ends up killing Uncle Ben. However, if you think about it, if Peter had never been bitten by the spider, he would never have been in that studio that night, and Uncle Ben probably would have been killed anyway. That's a bit of a moot point, but a nice thing to kind of marinate on. It's moot because, let's be honest, Peter was there. Peter could have done it, and he didn't, and that builds on Spider-Man himself. But again, it's hard to look at the origin and remove fatalism from it, because for Spider-Man to exist as a superhero, Uncle Ben must die. And to that, let me give you a chilling idea that will bother you for a while. Uncle Ben, contrary to the movies that have portrayed this, Uncle Ben died in the house. I've seen variations where he died on the front steps or in the living room, but he died in or around the Parker home, where they live. Their home became a crime scene. The chilling fact is that at some point, that had to be cleaned up. I don't know if May did it or if they hired somebody, what have you, but Uncle Ben's blood would have been in the house or on the steps. It would have been there. I just picture Aunt May trying to do CPR on Uncle Ben, and it chills me. It chills me right to the bone. And in my head, she's trying to talk to him, keep him from going into shock, and just watching as he passes away. One of the side effects of their home being a crime scene is that they have to live there. So every day when Peter lived with Aunt May, he's living in the house where Uncle Ben died because of his mistake. A constant reminder of what it means to be Spider-Man. Having Uncle Ben die in a carjacking or having Uncle Ben killed by a random robber doesn't have the same resonance. Regardless of Peter's actions in either iteration of the Spider-Man movie, either the Raimi movie or the Andrew Garfield movie, it loses something because the reminder of Uncle Ben's death, the very core of what keeps driving Peter to be Spider-Man, is removed from the equation. Sure, he can go visit the public library or he can go visit that street corner and get recharged or find the core of that emotion again, but there's something incredibly tragic about having to live in the place where your uncle died because of your mistake. And Peter's really honest with Tim about this, without being too honest. And Peter, well, he opens up emotionally. He tells Tim, maybe you shouldn't have me as a role model. Maybe it should be somebody else. I'm not deserving. It's not that he doesn't necessarily want to be a role model. It's not that he's shirking this responsibility. But Peter struggles to see himself externally. It doesn't help when you have J. Jonah Jameson calling you a menace every other day. But Peter really doesn't look at himself as a full picture. And I relate to that. I struggle to see myself externally, the good, the bad, the indifferent. So I get that piece of humanity that's in Peter. That's a real-world application of emotions. When Peter's talking about Uncle Ben, Friends nails Peter's body language. He's talking about making up for what he did wrong, that he'll be doing it for a long time. And Peter is hunched over, and it looks like he has the weight of the world on his shoulders. It's not over the top, it's not pointed out, but it is there, and it is, well, it's doing what it should do, which is be a part of the narrative. Suffice it to say, in the comic book format, the visuals are equally important with the words, because this is a visual medium. They should work together. And here, it does. More so, Friends is able to show Tim in a very clear light. Tim is shocked by this revelation, but simultaneously goes to comfort Spider-Man. That says volumes about Tim's character. Who he is, this is a kid who we know is sick, who is dying, and he's meeting his hero, and he's shocked by the humanity of the hero, but he understands it, and he's out to comfort this guy. That is some amazing character work in what comes down to a single image. And Spider-Man's eyes are very clear to me on this. For some reason, I was drawn to them. They've been through several iterations. Romita kind of gave them a more defined look. McFarlane blew them up. Ditko left them fluid, but kind of rigid. Actually, that extends to Spider-Man as a whole. Ditko's Spider-Man was a visual contradiction because he was both sharp angles and odd curves. Romita would streamline that and further artists would take it more into the curved and fluid territory, but Ditko managed to make something that I would say is very special about a character that he doesn't look traditional, I guess would be the way I would put it. Superman is all muscle. The Flash has a runner's body. Batman has a cape that kind of defines him. Spider-Man, in its earliest iteration, which is the Ditko visual, he was a teenager being a superhero at the same time. He's somebody that had no business being there, to be honest, because he's a kid. But he's in the grown-up world. He's fighting grown-up adult villains who are trying to kill him. I would say that's a certain oxymoron to itself. A kid trying to be a superhero. An anachronism in the world of superheroics. Ditko put this into the very core visual style of Spider-Man, and a lot of that has been lost over the years, unfortunately. Here, Friends manages to bring that back in a story that is appropriate to bring that back into. He's an anachronism here. He's a superhero who's a human being and opening up to a kid. He's not fighting a supervillain. That was all in the first story. He's being a human being. And we come to Tim, who dug spent bullets, slugs, out of a bank wall that shows his dedication and his fandom. But it also sets up Spider-Man talking about his spider sense. Like the origin, this is put in organically. It's not shoehorned in. It's a natural part of the story. It makes sense that Spider-Man would reveal this part of himself to Tim. And Tim as a person is somebody you'd want to open up to, not just because of his circumstances, but it ties into our fandom. A comic book reader can relate to Tim. We know what it's like to love something drawn and colored on newsprint so much, and how that can stir something in a fan. Stern takes the idea of a child collecting memorabilia, turns it on its head, and we're looking in a mirror. Especially if you're a comic book collector, we can relate to Tim, and that's what ends up hurting us even more at the end when we know Tim's eventual fate. And there is, within this, a stunning shot of Spider-Man looking out the window with the outside light shining on his face. It's this moment of quiet reflection. It's kind of when the story starts pivoting towards its emotional core. Because shortly after, we have Peter revealing his identity, and we get this in three shots. There's a moment where Peter wavers because he knows, common sense tells him he should not do this. But at the same time, Peter cares. Peter's a person of heart. And so we have the next panel with him removing the mask and then Peter in front of Tim, and the body language is practically animated. You can see exactly what's happening. Even though these are still shots, you get the idea of Spider-Man wavering and reluctantly taking that mask off. And of course, to an uninitiated reader, this is a gasp-worthy moment. He's showing him the secret identity. Something's up. But at the same time, Peter revealing himself is a nice metaphor. Throughout this story, he's been opening up, revealing layer after layer, and he's been brutally honest. But here we have the full revelation, the missing link to the whole story. I could be pedantic here, okay? I could. Because I feel like it could be pointed out that this could be a plan by Mysterio or some other villain to trick Peter into this. But I feel like that's a really cheap shot for a story that relies on sentiment. Is it a valid commentary? Yes, it is. But I feel like the story quality overrides that. By this point in the story, you don't care. Then we have this shot of Peter saying goodbye, and he tells Tim, this must make us buddies. We go from the showman Spider-Man to a fully revealed Peter Parker, and it's not a fake move. Peter is genuinely opening his heart, reluctantly, because Peter realizes if he does this, there's no going back. He's opening himself to this kid as a full-fledged human being, not as a superhero, but as Peter Parker, as a guy who just tries to do the right thing. And Peter also knows what we don't know yet in this story at this point, that Tim is dying, and that opening himself up, allowing himself to care, is going to hurt down the road. And that's sealed with the shot of Peter hugging Tim with a set of tears coming down his face. It's the final goodbye. And when we say final goodbye, it's the final goodbye. And Friends gives us this moment of open emotion, and then Peter puts the mask back on and puts his brave face back on so Tim doesn't know that he's hurting. And make no mistake, Peter is hurting here. He knows what the final goodbye means in this context. Of course, the story has been really avoiding Tim's condition, just building his character through Conover's column. And that's where the final revelation comes in, is within the column. It impresses me most that Stern and Friends managed to create a three-dimensional character that we grow to care about in 11 pages. A character that we've never seen before, and we will honestly never see again. But we end up mourning Tim, because it's built right. It's something that's on a sturdy foundation. We're not beat over the head with it, but when the revelation comes, it's like the rug being yanked out from underneath us. The story isn't trying to be clever with the twist. It's not a shock and gasp moment. That's where the mask comes off. It's a genuine moment of emotion. And like Peter, this story reveals itself in layers. And then we have that final sequence of Spider-Man swinging onto the wall outside the hospital, and he pauses. And just before he swings off, we get the revelation, and we have this defeated Spider-Man. He can't beat this. He can do nothing here. Friends is presenting a Spider-Man who is vulnerable. He's helpless, and that resonates. I've been there. You've probably been there. He has his moment, and he swings off and moves forward as best he can, which is Peter Parker in a nutshell. I'm going to be completely upfront with you here. I'm not even firing up the weeder meter this time. This story is a 5. Yes, the very first 5 for the show. And let me tell you why. Peter shows up in secret. This could be a big PR boost. And let's be honest, Spider-Man could use a PR boost. But no, there's no media team. There's no announcement. Nobody will ever really know what he did. This isn't for attention, is what I'm saying. And you know, there was a story about Mr. Rogers, and you know, I love Mr. Rogers. Fred Rogers was one of my favorite people on the planet. But Mr. Rogers visited a young girl in a coma once. No media, no nothing. He showed up, he had some puppets from his show, he talked to her with the puppets. Now, as cool as it would be that the girl woke up responding to the puppets, that's not what happened. Mr. Rogers spent some time with her, he left, but she did eventually wake up, and Mr. Rogers would continue to call, and nobody knew this story until after Fred Rogers passed, and the little girl, now grown up, told the story. To me, this action is the core of Spider-Man. The core of, with great power must come great responsibility. Spider-Man has nothing but good intentions. There are times when he goes about things in the wrong way, but his intentions are good. And that's the human element. Peter makes mistakes, we all do, but his heart is in the right place in the end. And you can say that Peter being Spider-Man is driven by guilt over Uncle Ben or by Gwen Stacy, and you'd be right to some extent, but let's be honest, to feel guilt about something, you must care for something. So for Peter to put on a costume and put his life on the line, on the daily, in order to offset some cosmic wrong that he feels, he has to care a lot. And there's the core, in my opinion, of the great responsibility. It is to care. It's trite, but it's not wrong. At the core, Peter has to care about people. He has to care about a city, his place in the world. And that extends to a sick little boy who just wants to meet a superhero. Peter Parker knows he can't save everyone all the time, which makes him a haunted hero. This story pits Spider-Man against a foe he can't beat, and that is cancer. As Spider-Man, he can't punch it, he can't fight it. As Peter Parker, his intellect, which is considerable, can't produce a cure. So this story gives us a simultaneous victory in granting Tim's wish, but a defeat in not being able to save Tim, which is the essence of a Spider-Man story. If anything, it's the essence of the Marvel storytelling style that Stan and Jack started out with. As people, as human beings, we're limited. We can only do the best we can with what we've got, and that extends to Peter Parker. Peter Parker represents us. Yes, he has great power, but he has great limitations at the same time. In the grand scheme of things, Doc Ock will always be back. The Vulture is going to return, the Lizard, what have you, and Spidey will win some, he'll lose some. And this particular story, this night, won't change the course of history. But it made all the difference for Tim. Tim got his wish granted, and in a big way. Spider-Man revealed his secrets. So from Tim's point of view, this is a win. This is a gift. To come back to something I was talking about a little bit earlier, as comic book fans, we're often looked at oddly for having love for something that is lines and colors on a page, but these things, these symbols, archetypes, whatever you want to call it, they can mean something to somebody. They can be hope. Villains can produce fear. They can be cautionary tales. They can be comfort food. They can be a mirror. They can be commentary on the world around us. It's not a coincidence that there are a great deal of cosplayers who visit sick children in the hospital. It's not a coincidence that certain window washers will dress up as superheroes when they do the work outside the children's wing of a hospital. It inspires something. All at once, this story defines Peter Parker. It defines humanity within Peter Parker. It's a reflection of us that caring a little bit can go a long way. It also makes a bold statement, whether intentional or not, that these comic books, yes, they're stories, they're fiction, but they can mean something to somebody. And no matter what happens, as fans of this material, nobody can really take that away from us. This is a story about the power of hope, about the power of humanity, and about the power of symbols and loving something and letting it bring you happiness. So yeah, just to defend it, this story is definitely a 5. And I get it that the first half of the issue is a standard superhero versus villain fight. This 11-page backup story is a pure treasure, though. So what kind of legacy does The Amazing Spider-Man number 248 have? Well, it's a lofty one. This is an issue that will always find itself on top 10 lists of Spider-Man stories, or even Marvel stories, to be honest. It's been emulated, such as the bridge rescue of the little boy in 2012's The Amazing Spider-Man, but never duplicated, because, just to use that as a perfect example, there was a bit of navel-gazing in that scene. While saving the little boy was a great scene, it really was there to show Peter's daddy issues, and kind of take something away from that. We do eventually get confirmation that Tim unfortunately did pass away in the 1991 Marvel Holiday Special. There we meet Tim's brother Joey, who kept Tim's scrapbooks. Now the story finds J. Jonah Jameson seeking a PR boost by donating a big check to the hospital, but in stark contrast to this story, Jolly Jonah is annoyed with the kids and wants photos of himself. Joey mentions this visit to J. Jonah Jameson and tells the Daily Bugle publisher that Tim died having achieved his life's goal to meet and befriend a superhero. And in my heart, I wish J. Jonah Jameson had never learned of this, because it keeps the purity. The story actually gives J. Jonah Jameson a moment of pause. That's the power of this story, even within the fictional universe. And it stands out to me, but isn't pointed out in the story, but Tim's brother also seems to be a patient in the hospital, just lending a little bit more tragedy to the story. To put it in a nutshell, the opening story with Spidey fighting Thunderball is easily forgotten. I've forgotten it repeatedly through the years. Not that it's a bad fight or a bad villain, it's fine. But Tim Harrison lives on in my heart, rent-free, and probably will till I'm old and gray. I may be in the nursing home someday, and I'll still be telling the orderlies about my favorite Spider-Man story of all time. And I know it's often bad form to end an episode on a down note. But, to be honest with you, it would be outright irresponsible to overlook that, in the real world, there are children like Tim, who struggle with cancer and other illnesses. It's not a pleasant thought. I know that. But I know that many of these kids may not get the moment that Tim did. So I want to ask you to consider donations to St. Jude's Children's Hospital or Make-A-Wish Foundation. Any donation helps. You can find St. Jude's online at stjude.org. You can read about their mission and make a one-time or recurring donation. The Make-A-Wish Foundation can also be found at wish.org. Remember that these are both .org sites, because you don't want to go to wish.com. Totally different thing. And again, any little bit can help. You're under no obligation here. No guilt trips, no judgment, but I want to put it on the table because I know there are some members of the Friends of Old Dave that may be moved to make even a small difference in the life of a sick child, and that is why I love you. So I know it's not the most uplifting ending to an episode, but reality is what it is, and I can give you a little bit that, yes, this is supposed to be escapism, but it's also supposed to mirror the real world. We can't always live outside the real world. Next time, we have our first two-parter, when Iron Man and Dr. Doom show up in Iron Man number 249. Until then, remember that not all cars can drive themselves like Kit from Knight Rider, so keep both hands on the wheel and don't expect the car to talk back. Trust my personal experience on this one. I'm J. David Weider. Thank you for stopping by my universe. This show is made for entertainment purposes only and does not draw revenue from the material discussed. All opinions are those of the host and do not reflect the opinions of any other individual, entity, or organization. Music is provided by Danya Valdovas. It is used based on a royalty-free agreement. For links to the artist's other works, please visit davesmarveluniverse.com. All other music or sound clips are believed used under fair use and are used for entertainment and illustrative purposes only. Copyrights lie with the copyright holders and no infringement is intended. If you're into the social medias, the show does have a Facebook page. Just search out Dave's Marvel Universe on Facebook. Or you can find me on Twitter, at Dave Weeder. Weeder is spelled W-E-T-E-R. Show notes, links to other podcatcher feeds, and much more are available at davesmarveluniverse.com, the home base for the show.